This is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the special report headline, The State of Small Business. When it comes to vitality, concentration per capita, and diversity of small businesses, Triangle towns show mixed results. That's the headline on the front page. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Special report, the state of small business, drivers of our economic engine. And this story is by Mark DeRoberts with research by G. Scott Thomas. What makes a city outstanding for small business? Put down this story and look around. If you had to pick one place in North Carolina to launch a new business, where would it be? The Triangle's long list of accolades place Raleigh and Durham among the state's top metros for small business friendliness. Specifically, Raleigh emerged from the new American City Business Journal study with the state's highest score for small business vitality. ACBJ analyzed 106 major metropolitan areas across America, with the top spot going to Austin, Texas. But several other markets also did well in the study, which used a 16-part formula to assess their small business climates. And North Carolina's largest two metros, Raleigh, number 17, and Charlotte, number 28, landed among the top 30 for being fertile metros for the creation and development of small businesses defined as enterprises with 1 to 99 paid employees. Three Florida metros took the runner-up slots behind Austin, Miami in second place, Cape Coral-Fort Myers in third, and Sarasota-Bradenton in fourth. Here are the five vital qualities these small business hotspots share in descending order of importance. 1. The local count of small businesses is growing rapidly. It's logical that the clearest indication of a positive climate for entrepreneurs would be a strong increase in the number of small businesses. We ran our 16-part formula through a statistical correlation test and found that the formula's two most important categories were small business growth rates over 3 and 1 year intervals. From 2010 to 2013, Raleigh led Durham, number 58 overall, with a 3.5% increase in small business growth, compared to Durham's 1.4%. For context, Charlotte had a 2.2% increase, while Greensboro and Winston-Salem each saw a little more than a 1% decrease in the number of small businesses. At Bayou Cafe in the heart of Durham's downtown district, Dorian Bolden is immersed in the budding small business climate. The owner of the popular restaurant and live music destination says, "The friendliness of Durham towards small businesses is unmatched. It's one thing to read about the hype of downtown Durham and a place for small businesses, but it's even more impactful to be a part of this community." Bolden says the growth is a testament of the Triangle's appreciation of independence and culture, pointing to independent mom-and-pop restaurants along with the variety of festivals from full-frame documentary film festival to Moog Fest. "What I enjoy most about owning Bayou Cafe in downtown Durham is being part of a collective community that loves its city. I'm surrounded by people who are equally excited about the continued growth of downtown Durham, but also working hard to preserve the diversity and authenticity." Bolden says Bayou serves as a hub for the surrounding small business community, a place where he not only interacts with fellow small business owners, but a place where he can mentor entrepreneurs looking to gain traction. Considering the amount of small business growth in the rapidly expanding city, Bolden says, "There's a general understanding. The pie is big enough for everyone, and if not, we'll increase the size of the pie." 2. Population is expanding briskly. This is a chicken-and-egg proposition. Does an increase in the number of small businesses, and hence in the number of jobs, attract more people to an area? Or does an upswing in population create more opportunities for entrepreneurs? "I think it's both. They aren't mutually exclusive," says Adrian Cole, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development. "With more people relocating here, there is more opportunity for small business owners and entrepreneurs to grow and scale. We're seeing increased interest in our area from funders from across the country. Funding for North Carolina startups doubled last year, with the majority of these deals in the Triangle, based on the Council for Entrepreneurial Development, CED's, latest Innovators Report. While Austin led the surveyed metros in population growth, Raleigh ranked fourth. Rounding out the top five were Cape Coral, Fort Myers, Florida, Houston, and the Charleston, South Carolina region. The five leaders in this category all ranked among the best 18 metros in the final standings. Our growing population has created great opportunity for established small businesses that have been in our market for decades, as well as innovative new businesses looking to launch here, says Cole. Raleigh alone is now home to more than 500 startup companies, totaling more than 2,500 jobs. We have seen impressive growth in the area's startup ecosystem as our population has grown, she says. 3. There's a deep stock of budding entrepreneurs. A small business, by definition, must have at least one paid employee, but the U.S. Census Bureau also tracks what might be called smaller businesses, the kind that people operate by themselves, often out of their own home. These are known as non-employer businesses because they lack payrolls, but they carry the potential to become small businesses. If their products or services become popular, many of these tiny enterprises could begin to hire workers. Our formula analyzed each metro's ratio of non-employer businesses per 100,000 residents. This factor scored high on the correlation test, proving to be a strong indicator of small business vitality. In North Carolina, the five largest metros' non-employer stats were relatively even, each with between 7,000 and 7,500 in 2013. Our entrepreneurs are recognizing emerging markets and needs and building for them, says Lewis Sheets, director of NC State University's Entrepreneurship Clinic. The local universities are a key source for ideas and talent. NC State, for example, on average, files for 150 patents each year and has launched 100-plus companies and 400-plus consumer products. In addition, NC State graduates 5,000-plus students each May. Combine this with the other universities in the Triangle, and the talent pool is quite impressive. The Triangle also is a rich environment of early adopters and informed customers. This is great for a startup needing to prove need and want fast. 4. Key economic indicators are trending in a positive direction. Here is another common sense conclusion. If employment and economic output are increasing at a nice pace, small businesses are most likely to prosper as well. The two economic indicators that correlated most strongly with small business vitality were growth in private sector jobs and gross metropolitan product, GMP. The latter is a measure of the annual output of goods and services within a given market, essentially the local version of the nation's gross domestic product. The two North Carolina metros to see the largest increase in private sector employment from 2012 to 2015 were Charlotte and Raleigh, each at about 11%, while the state's other metros logged about 6% growth. Raleigh led Durham and Charlotte in dominating the state's GMP increases from 2011 to 2014. Raleigh 8.8%, Durham 7.5%, Charlotte 7.4%, Greensboro 3.5%, and Winston-Salem 1.2%. Raleigh has an exceptional business climate with business costs that are nearly 20% below the national average, says Cole, adding that the local education systems not only produce top talent, but also are good for attracting professionals with young families. While many small business owners would find the Triangle's cost of living attractive, finding funding can be an obstacle for those looking to launch or sustain a business. Our investors are typically more risk-averse versus other areas in the U.S. where investors amassed fortunes by quicker methods, usually through entrepreneurship, says Sheets. The Triangle has been entrepreneurial in finding ways to address this issue. For example, Malartu Funds activates investors by lowering the investment amount needed per investor, or the NC State Acceleration Fund provides equity-free grants and an accelerator to better prepare new ventures to attract later investment. 5. There is a strong concentration of small businesses to population. You might expect to find little or no deviation between local ratios of small businesses per 100,000 residents, but the variations are actually quite substantial. Portland, Maine, historically, has been the leader in this category. Nobody seems to know why, not even the entrepreneurs of Portland. The latest count, which was taken in 2013, found 16,928 small businesses and 520,363 persons in all the Portland, in the Portland area, which translated to a ratio of 3,253 small businesses for every 100,000 people. Only one other market was above 3,000, Miami, at 3,025 businesses per 100,000 people. Warmer parts of the country tend to be the most promising regions for entrepreneurs. The South contains 12 of the nation's top 20 metropolitan areas for small businesses, while the West has 7. The only outlier hails from the East. New York City is 16th in the overall rankings. In North Carolina, the state's 5 largest metros are mostly on an even plane, with Winston-Salem's ratio of 1,900 being the exception. The other metros range from nearly 2,200 to 2,400. But a sunny address doesn't guarantee business success. The 2 metros with the worst small business vitality scores can also be found in the South. Last place, Augusta, Georgia, and next to last, Memphis. Both of these tail-ending markets lost more than 2% of their small businesses during the past 3 years, and their remaining concentrations are exceptionally low. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by digital producer Mark DeRoberts. The main headline, Baltimore developer forges ahead with Briar Creek plans. Here's an update on an important project which could be very prominent when built. Looks like Heritage Properties of Baltimore has scaled down on its plans for the Legacy at Briar Creek project. Public filings with Raleigh officials show that the group is now proposing a 115,000-square-foot, 4-story office building at the southeast corner of T.W. Alexander Drive and Briar Creek Parkway. The 9.5-acre site was purchased by the Maryland Group for $2.6 million last year. This project is particularly worth noting given the sudden burst of activity in the past year along the same corridor. Right across from the Heritage Project, a Raleigh developer, Kendall Oliver, paid $3.5 million for 12.66 acres last year to build a senior living facility called Cambridge Village. Not too far from these two projects rest the 460-acre Carolina Arbors by Del Webb housing community in East Durham, an age-restrictive, active adult development that is set to have 1,250 homes at build-out. Christensen, bathrooms that make you more comfortable. James Beard winner Ashley Christensen took to Facebook to voice both her stance on the contentious HB2 and also her response to a recent critic. Christensen, whose restaurants include the likes of Poole's Diner and the newly opened Death and Taxes, received a message criticizing new labels on her restaurant bathrooms, labels identifying them as people rooms instead of men's and women's restrooms. After telling the critic, whom she did not identify, that she wouldn't be relabeling the bathrooms, she shared the message publicly on her Facebook page. Anyone who has fought to contribute to our community by opening a restaurant has met far greater challenges than your threat to no longer eat our hamburgers, she writes. We wish you the best in your quest for the next great cheeseburger with bathrooms that make you more comfortable with who you are. First James Beard, then Terra Vita Fest. The annual Terra Vita Festival, which spreads the gospel of sustainable food and drink, will honor Chef Vivian Howard with a book dinner on September 29 during Terra Vita's festivities. Howard, the head chef and co-owner of Kinston's Chef and the Farmer, has starred in the award-winning PBS series A Chef's Life. Each ticket for the dinner will come with a signed copy of Howard's latest book, Deep Run Roots, Stories and Recipes from My Corner of the South, which is scheduled for release on October 4, 2016. Howard won a James Beard Medal on April 26 for her television series under the category Outstanding Television Personality. The Terra Vita Food and Drink Festival started back in 2010 and has earned a reputation as being one of the premier culinary events in the Southeast. Duke surgeon cited as most influential. Duke University's Dr. Shelley Huang, chief of breast surgery at the Duke Cancer Institute, has been named one of Time's 100 most influential people. She was recognized for her pioneering work in early-stage breast cancer, specifically in DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, an area of no small controversy. In February, a team led by Huang received a $13.4 million award to study very early-stage signs of breast cancer. And in a section called Hockey Meets Baseball, although they're done swinging their hockey sticks for the season, a handful of Carolina Hurricanes took a few cuts with a bat before a baseball game on April 27. Five members of the Carolina Hurricanes, Justin Falk, Jordan Stahl, Cam Ward, Brad Malone, and Ryan Murphy, joined the Durham Bulls for batting practice at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park prior to the Bulls game against Louisville. Some of the Bulls players offered a few pointers, and though they may not be as good at baseball as they are at hockey, the Canes players sure looked like they had a good time. Shearer joins Ask Him at a Raleigh concert. The great comic actor Harry Shearer, best known for his voices for 23 characters on The Simpsons, didn't disappoint when he visited Raleigh April 24 to join Raleigh Civic Symphony and Chamber Orchestra's conductor and longtime friend Peter Ask Him on stage at NC State University for a performance of Sergei Prokofiev's classic Peter and the Wolf. Shearer was actually in town for several days, joining in for rehearsals and a special performance for the students at Hunter Elementary. And from what we hear, Shearer, who spends much of his time now living in New Orleans, did it all on his own dime and even paid for his own plane ticket to Raleigh. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Pharma firm to occupy old Teleflex medical site in Durham, hiring 275. Aurobindo Pharma USA Incorporated, the New Jersey-based unit for an Indian genetic drug developer by the same name, has committed to establishing a new national headquarters for research and development in Durham, and bringing with it 275 jobs and $31.7 million in investment. Aurobindo executives are negotiating a deal to take over a former Teleflex medical facility at 2917 Weck Drive in Durham, near Research Triangle Park, confirms Ted Connor, Senior Vice President of Economic Development at the Durham Chamber of Commerce. The facility in Durham will allow the company to ramp up production faster than if company executives had decided to build a new plant on land it already owns in Dayton, New Jersey. State commerce officials say, though, they were told by recruiters, that Aurobindo's expansion into Durham was contingent on an economic incentive package. At the April 26 meeting of the State Economic Investment Committee, Aurobindo was approved for a jobs development investment grant worth up to $3.8 million over the next 12 years. The JDIG money will be in addition to another $400,000 in economic incentives approved in April by both Durham City and County leaders, plus about $467,000 in training through the community college system. Aurobindo already employs 14 people at an office facility in Raleigh. The company will be required to retain each of those jobs in the state in addition to the new jobs. United Health's tech outfit scopes North Hills area to set up new operations outpost. Optum, the technology and healthcare services arm of health insurance provider United Health Group, is joining the party among the Triangle's tech companies and their recruitment of high-tech talent in the region. Real estate sources say Optum has been scouting the Raleigh market for months with plans to establish a new office in the region. And they say the company has settled on a deal at North Hill's new Bank of America Tower office building in Raleigh. Optum has a space requirement of about 60,000 square feet of office space, or enough space for more than 200 employees. It would be the company's first major operations presence in the region. An Optum spokesperson would not disclose details of the new Raleigh office, except to confirm that the plan to move to Raleigh was decided about a year ago. The newly renovated office space at the Bank of America Tower could be ready for occupancy as early as June or July. Optum, which accounted for about 40% of UnitedHealth's operating earnings last year, also has office locations in San Francisco, Denver, Minneapolis, and Salt Lake City, but none in North Carolina to date. Building at Raleigh's Five Points to find new function. New owners of the old Audio Buys building at Five Points in Raleigh will soon be bringing new people and commerce back into the 1960s-era modernist-style building. Rick and Carol Marcotte, owners of the Form and Function Interior Design and Store on Bernard Street, purchased the odd two-story building at the corner point of Glenwood Avenue, Whitaker Mill Road, and Fairview Road in December. Carol Marcotte confirms that Form and Function will be taking over the building's second-floor retail and office space. The third level of the building will be turned into a rooftop garden. The bottom floor, which was previously used mostly for storage, will be leased to a complementary business that's also involved in the interior design industry. The redesign and renovation of the 1700 Glenwood building was also a winner of an AIA Triangle Merit Design Award at the awards ceremony on April 14. Tonic Design and Construction of Raleigh was the architect and construction firm that worked on the project. Replacing Zinda, restaurateur G. Patel is opening Bare Bones. Raleigh restaurateur G. Patel, owner of Echelon Experiences, will be opening a new restaurant concept called Bare Bones in the former Zinda building he closed in March. Bare Bones will feature a more casual menu of burgers and beef ribs and will add pool tables and shuffleboard games for guests. The new concept is expected to open in the summer. Gurley to open pharmacy market in Glenwood South. Former Wake County Commissioner and pharmacist Tony Gurley has plans to open a new pharmacy and grocery market when the new Gramercy apartment building opens in the summer. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance has awarded a $5,000 retail grant to Gurley to help in the upfit. The 7,000-square-foot store at 401 Glenwood is expected to have a full-service pharmacy, coffee bar, prepackaged sandwiches, salads, and soups, plus basic grocery items such as fresh produce, dairy, paper goods, wine, drinks, and beer. Watkins Flowers to leave Raleigh's Capitol Boulevard. Watkins Flowers, a staple along Raleigh's Capitol Boulevard for the past 50 years, will be moving this summer to the Lafayette Village Commerce Center in North Raleigh. Watkins Flowers has been at the same location at 2731 Capitol Boulevard near the Highwoods Office Park for more than 35 years, says co-owner Ed Karp. The new location at Lafayette Village will change little with their business model, he says, since most floral orders are now made by phone or online. The move, though, is expected to attract more foot traffic from shoppers coming to the other local venues at the center on Honeycutt Road. And now we turn to the On Pharmaceuticals page written by Jason DeBruin. The main headline, several local life sciences stocks stung by Wall Street. Investors in Triangle drug and medical device companies would probably rather just not look at their portfolios. In the past 9 months, 8 of the 9 publicly traded drug and medical device companies with headquarters in the Triangle have lost value. 7 have lost at least 45%, and 3 have lost at least 88%. The declines resulted from a failure to show safety or efficacy of the drug or device under development, a financial maneuver in the public markets, or a combination of both. Yes, the larger biotechnology sector has been down, but losses for Triangle area companies have been far higher. The NASDAQ Biotechnology Index is down 28% since July 13, the date used for demarcation in this story, but only two local companies bested that performance. If one can even call losing 23% instead of 28% bested. The specifics of each company differ, though most follow a similar pattern. Results from a trial to test a new drug or device didn't give the results that executives hoped for, and investors lost confidence in that new drug, driving down the value of the stock. As largely development stage companies, these drug developers don't generate revenue, and the failed trial means they must seek cash to continue research and development. At the lower stock price, however, companies must dilute existing shareholders more just to raise the same amount of capital, continuing the cycle that depresses share value. To salvage themselves, executives at different companies have targeted different strategies. Chapel Hill Sempra, for example, went ahead with a submission to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, despite a trial that included adverse events. Raleigh's Nephrogenics Incorporated terminated employment contracts with its CEO and CSO as it searches to complete a reverse merger. Durham's Chimerix cut 20% of its workforce, and the one company that has reported positive share gains wasn't immune to bad news. Durham-based Argos Therapeutics announced plans to cut 13% of its workforce to stay under budget for a late-stage treatment trial. The final chapter isn't written on these companies, but they certainly have a steep climb ahead of them. FDA greenlights Nanocor's move to forward heart drug therapy. A Chapel Hill biotech heard good news from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration on April 22. The regulatory body accepted an investigational new drug, IND, application from Nanocor Therapeutics Incorporated relating to carfostin, an experimental cardiac gene therapy in development for the treatment of congestive heart failure, or CHF. Simply accepting the application is still a long way from approving a finished drug, of course, but is seen as an important milestone for drug developers. Now, Nanocor may begin testing its therapy in human patients, and the company says it intends to initiate a Phase 1 trial in patients with advanced chronic heart failure in the second half of this year. In 2009, Nanocor raised $6 million to fund preclinical development. CHF is a major cause of morbidity and mortality, and there is a critical need to explore new therapeutic approaches, said Dr. Roger Hajjar, Nanocor's scientific co-founder and director of the Cardiovascular Research Center of Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York. Gene therapy is a viable option for the treatment of CHF, and our proprietary technology platform allows for targeted and minimally invasive delivery of the therapeutic to the heart. Heart disease is the leading cause of death worldwide, with congestive heart failure being the final stage of many heart diseases. About 5 million patients in the United States suffer from CHF, and it is one of the most common reasons for hospitalization in patients 65 and older. CHF is a condition to which the heart is unable to supply sufficient amounts of blood and oxygen to the body. CHF can result from conditions that weaken the heart muscle, cause stiffening of the heart muscles, or increase oxygen demand by the body tissue beyond the heart's capability to deliver. And finally, North Carolina hospitals grade well in patient safety. Nearly half of North Carolina's hospitals received a stellar grade for patient safety, a percentage that ranks this state 10th in the nation. Every state that ranked higher by percentage had fewer total hospitals, and only three states had more total hospitals that received an A than North Carolina, which had 39. The grades come from LeapFrog Group's Spring 2016 Hospital Safety Score. And now we turn to the On Technology page written by Lauren Onisorge. The main headline, as warned, Durham's Cree notes big drop in revenue, profitability. Cree CEO Chuck Swoboda said the company has addressed the delivery issues that contributed to the lighting numbers, and the innovation was picking up steam. Following the earnings report on April 26, Swoboda said repeatedly that Cree is first and foremost an innovation company. Sometimes the development takes longer than expected, but this is one of the risks of being in the innovation business, he says. We have addressed the delivery issues and innovation momentum. Cree notified analysts April 5 that a revenue miss was likely in the third quarter, a disclosure that sent the stock down below $25 a share, only the second time in 2016. And just as the company had anticipated, the biggest hit came in the lighting products segment. A year ago, that business unit, which made up 55% of the business, delivered $224.1 million. This time, the number was $187.7 million, but was still about half of the company's overall revenue. Cree reported a total of $366.9 million in total revenue for the quarter. While it's in line with that April 5 disclosure, it's a big drop from the company's initial range projection of $400 million to $430 million, and a marked decline from last year's third quarter, which brought in $409.5 million. The company did recognize an expense for previously deferred IPO costs related to the delay in the timing of its anticipated power and radio frequency division spin-out. The company plans to turn that RTP-based business unit, dubbed WolfSpeed, into a standalone public company later this year. Red Hat founder, pilots drone firm Precision Hawks' next route. Raleigh drone developer Precision Hawks' jet-setting CEO Bob Young says his company's just announced $18 million funder will play a big role in a federal mission aimed at making unmanned aircraft systems accessible for businesses in the United States. Young calls Precision Hawk as exciting as anything I've ever been in. Young, who also co-founded Raleigh-based Red Hat, says Raleigh has exceeded the expectations that company execs had when moving the headquarters here from Canada. Investments North Carolina made in its universities in the 60s are paying off in a big way for Precision Hawk, he says. The net effect is you have all these incredibly smart kids being attracted from across the country to come to school here, he says. Companies like Precision Hawk can simply find the talent in North Carolina that would be difficult to find elsewhere. Through a partnership with the FAA, Precision Hawk Technology is helping the feds develop rules that will affect the entire drone industry. The FAA's Pathfinder program is researching several drone applications. Specifically, it's working on urban drones through the likes of CNN, figuring out how to deploy the technology for news gathering purposes. It's working with BNSF Railway to explore command and control challenges using unmanned aircraft to inspect rail infrastructure. And it's working with Precision Hawk to explore technology aimed at figuring out how to do all of it safely. That includes testing beyond line of sight technology, and some of that testing has been happening in North Carolina. It's about knowing where the drone is at all times, and for the air traffic system to be able to keep the commercial drones safely away from manned aviation, he explains. It's one thing, he says, to fly a drone over a wedding for that perfect shot. It's something else when you're flying your drone 10 miles down a railroad. You have to make sure it knows all the risks that surrounds it. Regarding the latest fundraiser, he says getting multiple big businesses to sign on to the same funding terms was a feat in and of itself. But we are thrilled with the backing of USAA and Verizon, as well as the amount of international interest we're getting. We get to focus on the long-term success of our technology. Add $4.1 million to keep foot on the pedal for Windsor Circle. Windsor Circle, the Durham marketing technology firm, founded by a group of Bronto veterans, is about to double down on its platform. It's been a long journey for Windsor Circle CEO Matt Williamson, who went months without taking a salary at the firm, famous locally for the green pants worn by its employees, developed as the Windsor Circle CEO Matt Williamson, who went months without taking a salary as the firm, famous locally for the green pants worn by its employees, developed its technology. "This is everything the entrepreneurial journey is and should be," says Williamson. "It's an amazing experience. And a lucrative one, at least in terms of venture investment. Windsor Circle recently disclosed another $4.1 million in investment capital, a way to keep our foot on the pedal," says Williamson. "Already the team counts hundreds of global brands, from L'Oreal to Johnson & Johnson, among its clients. And the innovation continues, leading to more opportunities," Williams says. First, his company unlocked data from e-commerce systems, he explains. Next, the group applied data science, translating all that information for companies to use in retaining customers. And now, "we're trying to make it push-button simple," he explains, "and that's adding an easy-to-use interface. Windsor Circle, which recently moved into a new Durham headquarters, has developed technology that attempts to predict purchases and help retain customers. One big innovation out of Windsor Circle is what Williamson and team call the replenishment automator. A coffee maker, for example, isn't replenishable. You buy it once, then theoretically you're good for a few years. But the filter and the coffee itself must constantly be purchased, and that's the opportunity sought out by the company's automator. It goes through our entire data set and profiles the products that are replenishable," he explains. "Then it sends the exact right message at the exact right time to say, you're running out of coffee, and here's how you can order more." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. And first, we read a column written by Andrew Broad, who is a senior research fellow in UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. The headline on his column in the Viewpoint page, HB2's effects on North Carolina's reputation. In an old rabbinic tale, a man goes to a wise rabbi to atone for the sin of spreading gossip. The rabbi considers his appeal and then asks him to bring a feather pillow. The man is confused by the request, but he complies. The rabbi has the man go outside and rip the pillow apart. The day is very windy, and the feathers all blow away. The rabbi then asks the man to gather the feathers and fix the pillow. The man protests that this is impossible, as the feathers are gone for good. "Precisely," says the rabbi. "So it is with gossip. Once a piece of gossip leaves your mouth, it's as if it's carried away on the wind, and you can never get it back." What reminded me of this story was the deteriorating reputation of North Carolina in the national consciousness, and especially the business world. It's running out of our control, much like feathers in the wind. As everyone knows, the cause of all this is HB2, the state law that reversed a Charlotte ordinance granting rights to transgender people, though it also prevents local anti-discrimination ordinances, bans victims of workplace discrimination from suing in state courts, and restricts cities' ability to dictate wages and employment conditions to private employers. It's been said that law bans municipal minimum wage laws, but such laws were already banned. There's a reason that no North Carolina city had a higher minimum wage than the state's $7.25. In the month since the law was passed, corporations such as PayPal and Deutsche Bank have canceled plans to locate or expand in North Carolina, costing us thousands of jobs. Entertainers ranging from Bruce Springsteen, Pearl Jam to Cirque du Soleil have canceled concerts and shows. Renowned Broadway composer Stephen Schwartz has revoked performance rights to his musicals, including Godspell and Children of Eden in North Carolina. Conventions and meetings from Wilmington to Asheville have been moved to other states. The 2017 NBA All-Star Game will be moved out of Charlotte if the law isn't changed. And the federal government is reportedly assessing whether the law disqualifies North Carolina from receiving $4.5 billion per year in education funding. Some have started tallying the economic loss from HB2, but such calculations are likely to understate the economic impact, because it's not just about numbers, it's also about reputation. To be sure, it's not clear how long HB2 will last as a law. the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, which has jurisdiction over North Carolina, just ruled in a Virginia case that restrictions on how transgender people use bathrooms are discriminatory. But even if HB2 is repealed or overturned, will our reputation be restored? After all, the national media are talking about us and comparing laws in other states to North Carolina's HB2. If we don't watch it, we'll become a touch point, a catchphrase for discrimination. States like that tend not to thrive economically. The danger was driven home to me when I saw a national article about a North Carolina judge who threw a breastfeeding woman out of his courtroom. It wasn't as outrageous as the headline made it seem, and it's the sort of thing that happens all over the country. But the editor saw North Carolina and ran it. My guess is that it wouldn't have run before HB2. Once a narrative is fixed in the public's mind, it's hard to undo it. Will North Carolina be able to put the feathers back into the pillow? And also we have a letter to the editor. This comes from Catherine Collins, who is president of the Southeastern Wind Coalition. And the headline of her letter to the editor: offshore wind farms will do little damage to North Carolina's beach business. Last week, NCSU study, Coastal Wind Farms Could Hurt Tourism Spending, saw the release of NC State professor Dr. Laura Taylor's report discussing some of the potential economic impacts of an offshore wind farm off the coast of North Carolina. While the report clearly showed that wind farms located 12 or more miles offshore would have almost no negative impact to tourism, the story picked up by most media outlets instead focused on the possibility of reduced beach property rentals if turbines were located very close to shore. But for North Carolina, putting turbines that close to the shore is not even an option. North Carolina currently has 3 potential offshore wind farm locations, 1 to the north near Kitty Hawk, and 2 at the southern tip of the state. The northern area is more than 27 miles off the coast. The nearest area in the south is over 11 miles from the coast of Wilmington and 17 miles from the Bald Head Island coast. The photo simulations used in the NCSU survey started at 5 miles offshore, less than half the distance of the closest possible turbine location. The photo simulation also assumed ideal viewing conditions, which are uncommon, especially in the summer. According to analysis by the Federal Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, on 73% of summer vacation days, a beachgoer would not even be able to see 11 miles from the shore for more than half of the day. From an economic perspective, offshore wind farms bring significant opportunity. According to a 2015 Navigant Consulting study, the 720-megawatt offshore wind farm shown in the NCSU study would bring in an estimated 2,056 direct jobs and $436 million in direct investment. The indirect and induced jobs would total more than 7,000, and investments would be more than $1.3 billion in the state of North Carolina alone. In addition, there are several studies from areas with firsthand experience in offshore wind showing that offshore wind farms can actually add value to the tourism industry with site tours and information centers. Bringing the offshore wind industry to the state would be an incredible opportunity to lead in clean energy production, as well as an unparalleled economic development opportunity, all while protecting and enhancing coastal tourism. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the small business section, where we have a column written by Dana Manchagli, who writes for the Atlanta Business Chronicle, a sister publication. The headline on her column: How Tech Incentives Increase Employee Engagement. Employee engagement was identified as one of the 3 top priorities contributing to business success in a recent study conducted by Harvard Business Review Analytics Services. Companies have tried everything from pet-friendly policies, lunchtime yoga sessions, and branded company tote bags to connect with their employees. The trouble is, not everyone knows how to build these connections and measure their impact. This Harvard study found that many companies struggle to measure engagement and how it impacts business performance metrics such as customer satisfaction. I spoke with Peter Gossin, Product Marketing Manager on the U.S. Windows and Devices team at Microsoft, about how to find and provide the tools that employees need to do their jobs effectively and that also resonate with them on a personal level. I have a drawer full of pens and paperweights and other dust-collecting objects that were meant to recognize a company milestone or contribution, but they never created any connection or provided any lasting benefit, says Gossin. Gossin believes companies are missing a huge opportunity to connect with custom-branded technology and apps. Moderately priced tablets, many under $100, can be branded with a company logo and be loaded with customized content. He offers three examples of winning strategies using technology to increase employee satisfaction and engagement. Connect more closely with customers. Westgate Resorts is one of the largest resort developers in the world. Until recently, all of the company's nearly 80,000 annual closings proceeded along a paper path, requiring agents to print, review, sign, and ship more than 40 documents. Preparing these documents took time, which slowed down the process and tested buyers' patience. Automating this process and then providing buyers with a branded and customized tablet during the closing made the connection stronger because the signing process was easy, and Westgate had a way of engaging with their customers after the sale. Celebrate major milestones in style. A regional bank had just reached a major milestone and wanted to celebrate in style. To thank its employees for their contributions, the bank selected branded tablets and Bluetooth keyboards. Distributed at an annual holiday party, the gifts were presented in specially designed packaging with customized content that complemented the experience. The employees were delighted because the gift showed that the bank put effort and care into selecting something truly valuable and useful for them. Recognize and reward employees and make it meaningful. Employee gift-giving programs of the past were generic and usually reserved for holidays and work anniversaries. Time to go beyond the mug by recognizing what is most meaningful to your employees. Royal Caribbean knows its crew members are at the heart of the great vacations the brand delivers. It also recognizes the level of commitment it takes to live aboard a cruise ship, so they decided to invest in technology that made it possible to stay in touch with friends and family. Now they can talk face-to-face with loved ones via Skype, share photos, and send and receive email. The boost to crew morale was so high, Royal Caribbean is giving branded tablets to its more than 40,000 crew members. The Harvard study found there has been a shift toward investing for growth and away from cost reduction. 24% of responding companies now say they are investing for growth in the coming year, while only 16% said they were doing this over the past 3 years, representing a significant shift toward investment. Gossin agrees and says that because they are more affordable than ever, it makes good business sense to invest in tablets as part of customer reward or employee incentive programs. When people are empowered to work from anywhere using today's smart devices, brands can affordably delight their employees and customers and enable memorable experiences. Says Gossin, you build employee and customer engagement by going above and beyond what's expected. And now we turn to the People on the Move page in the Triangle Business Journal. And the spotlight is on John Hudson, EVP and Chief Intellectual Property Officer at Aseptia. On the heels of a large business-focused transition, Raleigh's Aseptia has hired John Hudson, former co-leader of Deloitte Advisory's U.S. Intellectual Property Advisory Practice, as Executive Vice President and Chief Intellectual Property Officer. Back in March of this year, Aseptia, a food technology company, got out of the manufacturing business and sold two plants in Troy and Biscoe, North Carolina, to a subsidiary of Ameriqual Group Holdings. Specifically, the sale transferred the assets of Wright Foods in Troy and Carolina Dairy in Biscoe to the new company. As part of the transaction, the companies inked a long-term licensing deal, enabling Ameriqual use of Aseptia's food processing technologies, AseptaWave, and AseptaSense. In his new post, Hudson is responsible for all aspects of managing, commercializing, and extracting value from Aseptia's intellectual property portfolio. He's also a member of the executive leadership team that sets and executes on the company's strategy. Aseptia now employs about 10 people and is helmed by David Clark. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? That intellectual property or IP in some shape or form, patents, trade secrets, know-how, software, copyrights, proprietary algorithms or processes, brands, trademarks, or even a customer list, is what drives the underlying value of company, big or small. The IP must protect the product or service generating revenue, as there is always someone bigger with smart people and access to more capital that can come in and disrupt your business. What are some of your major goals for your new position? To establish Aseptia as a technology and intellectual property company, to deploy our technology globally via commercialization partners, to bring maximum value to Aseptia's shareholders, and to our partnership with NC State University. Biggest worry? My biggest worry is that today's children aren't focused on STEM-type programs, science, tech, engineering, and math, and that the U.S. will fall further behind in innovation. Triangle area business person you most admire? First and foremost, I admire Aseptia scientists who also work with NC State University, specifically Josip Simunovic, who is a co-founder and science advisor to the company. Personal, wife Erin, daughter Avery, sons John, Aubrey, and Alden. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the list that starts with the Million SF Club. Here's a closer look at the three largest shopping centers in the Triangle, each boasting more than a million square feet of leasable space. Triangle Town Center and Commons, Raleigh. Hours of operation, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday, noon to 6 p.m. Sunday. Number of stores, restaurants, 135 plus. Number of parking spaces, 6,228. What you may not know, CBL and Associates on February 8 finalized the majority sale of the mall property to DRA Advisors LLC. The total property was valued at $174 million, and the deal includes assumption of a $171.1 million loan secured by the property. CBL retains a 10% ownership stake in the property and keeps control of its leasing and management duties. The streets at South Point, Durham. Hours of operation, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday, noon to 7 p.m. on Sunday. Number of stores, restaurants, 161. Number of parking spaces, 6,500 plus. What you may not know, the mall offers a variety of services including ATMs, auto jump starts, a children's play area, family restroom, UPS and FedEx drop-off locations, free Wi-Fi, a nursing lounge, and weekend valet parking. And finally, Crabtree Valley Mall, Raleigh. Hours of operation, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday, noon to 7 p.m. on Sunday. Number of stores and restaurants, 230. Number of parking spaces, 7,200, two-thirds of which are covered. What you may not know, the mall has a community room at its food court pavilion that can be rented out for events, including meetings, training seminars, and birthday parties. And with our remaining time, we'll try to make it through fashion trends, a macro look at retail construction. 441 million plus. The square footage of shopping center space that was under construction around the world at the end of 2015, up from 419 million in 2014, according to CBRE. China is by far the most active market as a pipeline and for delivery of new space, the firm says. 60%. the amount of total global retail construction activity that is now taking place in just four Chinese cities, CBRE says. 15. The number of major projects under construction, up from 9 in 2014, according to CBRE. The 15 shopping centers under construction are broadly diversified among new lifestyle centers, super regional and regional malls, and power centers, says Melina Cordero, CBRE's Director of Retail Research for the Americas. American Dream at Meadowlands. One of the largest retail projects in the New York City metropolitan area, which ranked number one busiest U.S. retail market, the World Trade Center and Hudson Yards redevelopments in Manhattan, and the City Point redevelopment in downtown Brooklyn are some of the other larger developments in the area. 1.5 million. The square footage of retail space under construction in Houston, the second busiest U.S. retail market, with four significant projects under construction. And finally, Los Angeles, the number three market with regard to retail square footage under construction, with 766,142 square feet scheduled for completion this year. And finally, we have a section called A Closer Look concerning the list of the largest shopping centers in the area. 15.7 million. The cumulative leasable square footage of the 25 largest shopping centers in the Triangle. 331,000. The total vacant first quarter 2016 square footage for the 25 largest shopping centers in the Triangle. 12. The number of Triangle shopping centers in the Triangle with more than 500,000 square feet of leasable space. And the number 5. The number of shopping centers on the list with no vacancy in first quarter 2016. And about this list, the information was gleaned from information in TBJ's first quarter 2016 space survey. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.